Welcome to Senate Judiciary. We're going to begin today with approximately an hour of testimony on 555, or triple nickel, as some people call it. We've had a work group that has met three times trying to iron out the distinctions between the dash 3 and the dash 4. They resulted in the dash 8, which were passed out or available on Friday afternoon. In addition, Senator Gerfler has the dash 5, 7, and 9, which relate to specific preventative measures, and we're going to take some testimony on that first from a series of people, and it includes, we're going to hear from Hill Walker at the University of Oregon on the issue of violence and destructive behavior, Nancy Miller and Carl Ward on CASA, and then Jane Phelps and Lane from Lane County, and Sue Miller from Marion County on Relief Nurseries, and then additionally on Family Resource Center from Peggy Perkerson from the Harrisburg Family Resource Center. And then we're going to go for a report on the Dash 8s in the meeting that's taking place today and hear from Steve Marks, Randy Franke, Scott Johnson, and Gloria Griffin. Is that correct?
Well, she's here on, I believe, for another issue, the same issue. I believe it's either Relief Nurseries or Family Resource Center.
All right. So that will take the first hour of our committee's time, and let's see. Karen Smith was here a moment ago. Is Senator Gerfler here? Are you going to present the amendments? That's good. Yeah. Oh, yes, and welcome, Representative Piercy. It's nice to have you.
Thank you for inviting me.
And we'll be joined by our other members as they complete their hearings that we're still going. So, Karen, if you could introduce yourself and briefly touch on the Dash 5, 7, and 9 amendments, please.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Karen Smith, and I'm a policy analyst with the Senate Majority Office. Senator Gerfler, unfortunately, was not able to come here today, so he asked me to go through his three amendments that he's proposing to Senate Bill 555. The first amendment relates to four programs that focus on early intervention programs, and these are reflected in the Dash 5 amendments, beginning on page 20 and running through page 21. As you heard, the committee will hear from several people today who will discuss each of the programs in more detail. So what I'll do is just outline the amendments. The first piece relates to crisis nurseries, and it funds the existing crisis nurseries and would expand those nurseries to two additional sites, which would be determined through a planning process initiated by the State Commission on Children and Families. The second piece relates to family resource centers, and the bill would fund the three existing demonstration projects and add 9 new centers. The expansion, again, would be determined through a planning process initiated by the State Commission. The third piece is the First Step program, which focuses on at-risk kindergarten students who have behavior or conduct disorders. And this provision in the amendment would allow the expansion of those sites in conjunction with the University of Oregon Center for Violence and Destructive Behavior. Hill Walker, I believe, will address that later. And the final piece relates to court-appointed special advocates that appropriate funds to expand this program. The second amendment is reflected in the Dash 9 amendments. These are formerly the Dash 6 amendments, and they relate to the Healthy Start program. The amendment, the Dash 9 amendments reiterate in statute that it's the intent to roll out Healthy Start statewide. This voluntary program has had a great impact in making sure that children are healthy and their families are strong and nurturing. The amendment also creates a joint interim task force that would be appointed by the Senate President and the House Speaker to look at the feasibility of a coordinated early childhood assessment program statewide. And this task force would make recommendations to the next legislature. The third amendment, which is reflected in the Dash 7 amendments, would appropriate funds to be distributed by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to counties for juvenile services. And those services are detailed as detention, treatment services, shelter, graduated sanctions, and aftercare services for youth offenders. So that's the essence of the three amendments that Senator Durfler is proposing. I don't believe that they conflict with the work group activities and what's been going on, and they could be folded into whatever final bill is agreed upon.
Thank you. Committee, earlier, a few weeks ago, we passed out the Children's Families Commission budget, which included an additional $5.5 million for the extension of Healthy Start, and it was specifically addressed to Healthy Start, and I think it expanded to an additional five or six counties. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so that funding element of the DASH 5 amendments has been taken care of. And one reason why the interim task force is, I think, a good idea, it'll take a look at the entire parameter of programs that is 0 through 18. And right now, reviewing Healthy Start, which is more or less has its own statute, does have its own statute and own funding. Head Start was an issue at one time, and how it goes through the Department of Education. It's in a separate agency, separate funding. But logically, these programs need to work together and tie in and work into the spectrum of things we're trying to provide at the local level. So the interim committee would also look at those issues. And to some extent, they'd be doing part of the work that the Juvenile Justice Task Force has been doing, especially as it relates to the higher-end, higher-risk teenagers. So there could be some blending there as we work the bill to see how that should fit. But are there questions for Karen, who is the principal draft person on the 5, 7, or 9? If not, yes.
I just want to clarify, you, in your remarks, just stated the 5 points million within the commission on the children and families budget, and that is what this DASH 5 amendment deals with?
Well,
the DASH 9.
It's the 9, not the 5. It provides for the expansion of the Healthy Start program, with a goal, of course, ultimately to get to all counties. My comments were directed to the fact that probably the amount we're going to invest in expansion has already been decided by being the 5.5 that's already passed through the Ways and Means process. I think it's completed. Is it gone through the House, too?
So it's done. It'll be on the floor this week.
Right. So as this bill goes down to Ways and Means, the purpose of my comment was to say we've already enhanced the program for Healthy Start, and whether or not there'll be additional funds will probably be doubtful.
Is there any specific reason why there's no number on the task force, or am I missing that?
Is there a specific number on the task force of people that would be included?
No, just that priority should be given, that members of local commissions and communities and health departments should be involved, but there is not a specific number of members.
Other questions? Thank you. We'll now invite Bill Walker.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Thank you very much. My name is Hale Walker. I'm co-director of the Institute on Violence and Destructive Behavior in the College of Education at the University of Oregon. The Institute is focused on the prevention of school violence and the at-risk conditions within the context of schooling that lead to aggressive, disruptive, antisocial behavior patterns among at-risk children and youth. I prepared a copy of my testimony for you, and also a packet of information on the third step to success program that I would like to briefly address at the end of my remarks. There are four issues that I'd like to touch on, and they are the importance of early intervention, the need to find and serve all at-risk children in the 0 to 6 age range, the crucial urgency to create a seamless continuum from birth to school entry that serves this population and also includes effective methods of screening, early detection, intervention, and the provision of supports and services. And finally, the dearth of programs that address aggressive, challenging forms of behavior at the point of school entry. Increasingly, we're finding that more and more at-risk children are showing up at the schoolhouse door who've had no prior contact with supportive service systems, and they're already showing clear signs of having developed an antisocial behavior pattern that, if left unaddressed, will function much like an immune system suppressant or disorder, and it sets them up for a host of very unfortunate events and conditions during their school careers and beyond, not the least of which are school failure, rejection by teachers and peers at about age 10. If they remain invested in this behavior pattern and it becomes elaborated, they get rejected by parents and caregivers as well. Many drop out of school in grades 8, 9, and 10. When they get on the streets, their risk status literally skyrockets. It's estimated that 80% of daytime burglaries in this country today are committed by out-of-school, school-age youth. 80%. Before I sort of step through these four topics, I'd like to take a few minutes and present some additional background information. Is that all right?
Sure. Well, let me just use our experience in this country and other parts of the world in the past 20 years has identified some clear linkages between exposures to risk factors at family, neighborhood, school, and private levels that lead to what are called very unfortunate maladaptive forms of behavior that in turn set an adverse child up for negative short-term outcomes, and they in turn are closely linked to very destructive long-term outcomes. So it's a risk that operates that increasing numbers of children are exposed to poverty, abuse of all kinds, neglect, incontinental weak parenting, drug and alcohol abuse by caregivers, and that list
goes on and on up to about 30.
Children who are exposed to this set of conditions from the moment of birth are very at risk for developing coercive, challenging forms of behavior that we collectively refer to as antisocial nature and cognitive disorders. An example of the kind of behavioral reactions that develop out of this cluster of risk exposure. The clients of the girl watch us to bed in a coercive anxiety, aggression with peers, and a lack of problem solving skills. They tend to approach their social environment with one strategy, that is, it doesn't work to do it harder, it doesn't work to do it harder still. They don't develop alternative ways of doing it. We have a lot of problem solving and mental to do that. Well, children who bring this behavior pattern to schools are continuing the school fails.
If you're successful in school, you're likely to be successful in life.
And nothing puts these children's school careers at greater risk than this behavior pattern that they walk in and do the school out of the way. So they still have short-term
outcomes that result from this behavior pattern over fortify the future of the schools in good truancy, fear and teacher rejection, low academic achievement, our hope of school discipline referral for teachers and students to the prom. Because they may think over the behavior, they do things that teachers cannot handle. A large number of different school retention, that's a very strong risk factor for antisocial behavior, delinquency, and not graduating from high school. You can look at the adolescent at-risk antisocial population. Many of them are now in temporary corrections in public spaces. And think of them in terms of who are group. Those who are socialized to this antisocial behavior pattern from the moment of birth, due to the family, neighborhood, and other kind of risk conditions that they live in. So this becomes in a sense a lifestyle. It's their reality from the moment of birth. They are severely at risk, and they are socialized inadvertently to this behavior pattern by family, caregivers, neighborhood conditions, and other factors. There's another group of youth and adolescents who begin having all sorts of problems at school and out of school, sometimes including contact with corrections and public safety. That's all later from. They have all the advantages. They do well in the elementary treatment. But starting in middle school, sometimes upper elementary, they begin affiliating with the early start, and they coalesce into, let's call it, deviant peer groups. Once you're a member of that deviant peer group, on average, you have your first felony arrest within
2 years in 70% of cases. People that I talk to in law enforcement and corrections say that for every arrestable offense,
for every arrest, there are 10 arrestable offenses committed. So you get some idea of the rate ratio. The outcomes for this group of later starters are much better than for your starters. If you make it all the way into adolescence as an early starter without appropriate intervention, support, and services, designed to get you off that path, your future is really dim. But late starters, because they have all sorts of advantages in terms of their family, background, neighborhood, and so on, have a much better, a much more positive life outcome. They will respond effectively to drug and alcohol prevention programs. They'll respond well to receiving instruction and coaching in prevention skills and strategies. They respond well to mentoring programs and counseling. Structure that helps them create schedules and deal with predictable, consistent environments. So if you look at our current at-risk population in Oregon,
and in most of the states, who are in the age
range, say 10 to 13, they would fall into one of these groups. What we tend to do, particularly in schools, is to bet that these youth know the behavior pattern at school. They appear at the school high school in kindergarten grade 1 with a challenging, difficult, disruptive behavior pattern. We bet that they will go out, that through the socializing experiences of school and so on, they will come out of it and everything will be fine. What the evidence shows is instead of going out of it, they go into it. This is a graph that shows the number of at-risk children and youth who are identified and served as severely emotionally disturbed
in our public schools. And this graph
represents 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8,
The thing that's wrong with the draft is there's a very low rate of teen detection and referral early on in the ages. And if you move up to the age continuum, so we get into grade 5, grade 6, grade 7, grade 8, 9, and so on, you shift to sort of really experience a flooding of referrals and demand for services for the population. The longer you wait, the more difficult it is and expensive it is for the cycle. You can approach anything that we would call a complete turnaround cure. So there's a song, you know, it's I'm good to rule the world, I rule the world, it's trash to look like that. So you can make having said that, I would like to strongly argue that it's never too late to intervene, never too early, never too late. We have a continuum represented by the youth, and the longer you are on that continuum, the older you are, the more likely it is you will have problems of greater severity and intractability. That doesn't mean you don't deal with it. These youth children have to be dealt with wherever they are along that continuum. But in terms of investment, in terms of return on that investment, you probably have the greatest ultimate return down in here. But that, I'm pleased interpret that message. What I'm simply trying to say is that you need to art. You need to intervene all along the continuum, but if you're able to put more resources than we can do into it early on in the early stages, then I think we can actually be used on that phenomenon that takes a big return. There are three pathways to sort of becoming involved with a behavior pattern that gets you in contact with self-education, correction, One is a covert path, one is an overt path, and one is an oppositional behavioral path. And most at-risk children and youth will pick one of these paths. I mean, they don't go, oh, I think I'll take that thing. That's just the way they're set up. Most will pick one path. Some will pick two. And by middle school, some will engage in all three. So the more paths you pick, the more secure you are in the way of your problem, the less responsive you are likely to be. There's a couple more, and I'll stop. This is a graph of what I call the behavioral escalation game. This is a pattern that's generally learned at home and is inadvertently taught, and the way it works is
if I'm the young child and you want me to do something and I don't
do it, I sort of whistle and cry out at you. And you back away and say, okay, well, you really feel that way.
You don't have to do it.
What if I can talk? I can talk that if I want to do something, even something I'm supposed to do, my whistling and crying and showing up and getting angry, I can intimidate you out of making that request. I can make you resolve that request. So this is basically what these children learn. It's a very, very unfortunate strategy of escalating whenever you want something. Whenever you want to get out of something, you confront, you escalate, you attack, you threaten. So they bring this behavior pattern to school, and learn the whole, it works even better at school with teachers who are not trained to deal with it, and it does at home. So I'm sitting in a class, and I forgot my assignment, I didn't do it, or whatever. The teacher asked me about it, and I'm being the ripple. And the teacher whistles back. I mark the teacher marks me. Within about 50 or 60 seconds, we have a behavioral episode that looks like an earthquake. Comes out of nowhere and does incredible damage. We have a long time for recovery. This is something that we have to teach teachers
have it over and have and teach children how not to do. You got to teach them to meet the principle that I'm going to.
Even more ominously,
they use this approach with their peers. And when I speak to groups who have
law enforcement and correction personnel,
there's a lot of headlines. Because this is a 60-second task.
The violence. You have groups of youth who are agitated.
And say one of them accuses another of backbiting. And the other says, no, you're wrong, I didn't do it. And furthermore, I don't like being with that person. Well, within several exchanges, you're at the point of accepting this, unfortunately, with
guns and knives and clubs and other things rather than words and fists that you do when I do it.
So this is called a 60-second pass to a 911 call. And it's very, very serious. The
most preferred strategy
is to try to get this little person off this path as soon as you possibly can.
And intervening as early as you can in the child's life.
But for a lot of reasons, we aren't able to do that. So as this little person moves along this path, their risk status increases, their problems increase, they become less likely to
yield successful students, and they run all
some of this. It's never too late to try and deal with the problems that they have along this path. But your best chance to get them off it onto a new path is early on in its life. I talk to a lot of groups about prevention.
And this is often the audience reaction when I talk about prevention. It's like, my job is a prevention and a head of the game for your check.
And we all know how easy it is to hurt cats and how they react when you try to hurt them. But I'm assuming that is not the case here.
Well, I'd just like to take a couple minutes to address this, and if you have questions or comments, I'd be happy to try and respond. Early intervention is a very, very good investment, particularly for this problem that we're seeing more and more of and the tragic consequences of. The most effective early intervention prevention programs are those that begin early in a child's life, that involve collaborative partnerships between homes, schools, and communities, and that involve the three most important social agents in a child's life, and those are parents and caregivers, teachers, and peers. You can develop an intervention that incorporates those three social agents. You are doing really well, and they're more likely to be effective. The need to serve all at-risk children in the 0 to 6 age range, in spite of our best efforts in Oregon and across the country, we're missing a significant portion of very at-risk children. John Cooey and his associates recently reported a study. He's at Duke, and he's been involved in a long-term study of this population called the F-Track. And they did a search of all the programs in Durham, North Carolina, that are set up to serve cohorts of at-risk children. And even doing a door-to-door search, they were only able to identify and find about two-thirds of the at-risk population that they need to be there. And his notion is that when that one-third shows up in kindergarten or first grade, having had no services, no interventions, no support, being exposed to these risk factors for 5 years, that they are likely to be the most severe cases that we see. So I think addressing that problem at some level, perhaps creating a task force, I'm not sure what the best answer is, but I think it's an important one. Creating a seamless continuum of supports and interventions and services for this population and their families from birth to school entry is critically important. You've made investments in Healthy Start. You've made investments in the Relief Nursery. You've invested in Head Start.
We need a similar system of support services and intervention for children who are age 5 and 6. The transition from Head Start or preschool to first grade is probably the most important transition children will make in their lives. And a large number of our children show up vulnerable, shaky, not ready, having coercive behavioral styles, and they drop through the cracks, and they get off to a poor start, and that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. My colleagues and I at the University of Oregon have been studying this population in the context of preschools and schools since 1966, and we're convinced that we have the technology, the interventions, the instruments, the procedures to find these little guys and girls early as they enter school to get them the supports and services they need to intervene in partnerships with their families and caregivers and community agencies as appropriate. And I won't go into it, but we have developed a best practice model intervention program called First Step to Success, and that's your packet. It was developed through a four-year federal grant. It's now used in about 15 states nationwide and in seven Canadian provinces. It's a highly effective program. It costs about $400 per child. It takes three months to implement. And it produces durable, impressive gains that tend to maintain within and across school years. And I think the reason that it maintains so well is because we involve parents and we start early. So thank you. So if you have any questions,
Phil, how do you know that it's a successful project? What kind of longitudinal studies have you done to show that there are good measurements that this makes a difference?
I'll start with the measurement question. There's an expression in my field that everything begins with good measures. So you need to use measures that are sensitive, reliable, accurate, predictive, and that connect up with important outcomes in the child's life. In other words, you have measures that over time, longitudinally, will show that a certain profile on them will predict either not good outcomes or good outcomes. They have to be able to predict in both directions to be effective. And they need to be sensitive in detecting intervention effects. I think you need to use three types of measures in that regard. One are direct behavioral observations where you go into classrooms and playgrounds and you actually code the child's behavior in terms of what they're doing moment by moment, second by second. That's the most direct and sensitive measure. Another set of measures are what I call informant measures. Those are the parents, teachers, and peers. And you ask them to make judgments about the child's behavior based on what they've seen before the intervention, during the intervention, following the intervention. And finally, you look at archival school records. Schools accumulate archival records on their students as a natural process of schooling. So you have rates of attendance, achievement test scores, number of discipline referrals of a teacher by a teacher of a student to the front office and so on. So using those three general types of measures, you can really triangulate and get a very, very good look at a child's adjustment and success. You have a table in your packet, looks like this. We were able to implement the First Step program in Eugene schools in 1993-94 and also 94-95. And we had two cohorts of very at-risk kindergartners who were evaluated prior to the intervention on four teacher rating measures and one observational measure. So we had them looked at prior to the intervention, 3 months later following the intervention, and then every year for cohort one through the fourth grade, every year for cohort two, which started a year later, through grade 3. They're now in grades 5 and 4, and we've probably run out of steam because the numbers in the two groups are getting so small because you can only track them so long and so far. Parents move and all kinds of things happen. So in terms of magnitude of effects, does this make a difference? There's a metric used in our field called effect sizes. And an effect size means how well does your intervention group do in comparison to your control group that didn't get the intervention. If your control group does better than your intervention group, you get a minus effect size. If your intervention group does better than your control group, you get a plus effect size. An effect size from 0 to 0.30 is sort of nothing to write home about. An effect size from 0.30 to 0.7 is something to begin to talk about, crow a little, and so on. An effect size at 0.8 and above is really impressive. Across these four measures here and across cohorts 1 and 2, the average effect size is 0.86. For the first step program. So it is a very powerful intervention.
So, other questions? This corresponds too with what research by the RAND Corporation as far as investment early on versus investment later on. They studied it from the standpoint of the California criminal justice system and early intervention, and they had a
I guess a couple of questions. One is percentage of children at risk, if you're able to determine that. And then the second one is do you have problems implementing a program where you have to have the teachers, parents, and everybody together? And do you have any sort of legal problems as far as that's concerned about getting parents and children involved in this program?
In regards to your first question, national studies, it varies by state, but not a lot. National studies show that 6 to 9% of students sitting in our classrooms today fit this profile of the antisocial student. The vast majority are boys. However, girls are becoming more like boys in this regard, unfortunately. About 25% of violent acts at school are now committed by girls. But you can think in terms of 6 to 9% of the in-school population have this profile. In terms of getting everyone to work together, what we don't do is try to coerce parents. Many parents of these students have very unpleasant memories of their schooling experiences, some are hostile towards school and so on. So what we do is look at all kindergartners and those that seem to be in need of a program like this, not ready for school and so on. We contact the parents to see if it's all right to evaluate them further. And if they say yes, and the child turns out to be one who could benefit from the program and qualifies for it, we go back to the parents and say, we have this intervention program, it takes 2 months, we describe it. And we would, it's designed to help your child get off to the best start possible in school. And we would like to know if you would work with us in implementing it. So their initial role is simply to support the teacher, support the child, communicate with the school, praise the child's performance at home, you know, when he does or she does well at school and so on. Most parents who are contacted will agree to participate at that level. Now, 2 weeks after the school intervention is up and running, we go back to the parents and say, we have a little curriculum. It takes 5 weeks, and it takes about 2 hours of your time a week. And the idea is to help you learn how to teach your child school readiness skills. And the skills we're talking about are doing your work, cooperating with others, developing your child's sense of I can do it, you know, self-efficacy, self-esteem, learning how to accept limits, learning how to be ready for school and learning how to problem solve. When a problem comes up that your child has difficulty with, you know, it's teaching them a variety of ways to problem solve through it. And probably half the parents that we ask say yes and half say no. And so you get a good effect if you can only do the school part of the program. You get a better effect, obviously, if you can do the home and school. But we don't blame the parents. We don't in any way coerce them. It's totally a voluntary program. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
I think it's
okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Phil, kind of stepping out from the First Steps program, the second step, does that somehow intermesh with the first step?
In terms of the programs and the names and the way they were developed, there's no connection between them. They develop totally independently of each other. But it's a good question. I think that the second step violence prevention curriculum, it teaches social skills that such as empathy, impulse control, anger management, and conflict resolution and problem solving. Four major clusters of skills. And it's set up now to be taught kindergarten through middle school. There's also a parent component. But it's taught just like reading, math, science, and biology, social studies. You teach it as academic content. It generally is taught 3 to 5 hours a week in the schools that, you know buy into it. To make the program successful, you need to have everybody in the school who's willing to then recognize and support and encourage children to use the skills in their daily interactions that are taught in the curriculum. And when that's done, it's highly effective. But what it does is changes the climate of the school and makes it more supportive, more positive, and it creates a wonderful context for implementing a program such as First Step that's designed for an individual child to be applied case by case. Individualized interventions will be more effective in a school like that than they would be in a school if you didn't have that sort of overarching curricular concept. So I recommend second step probably.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
We'll now invite Nancy Miller and Carol Ward and others.
Carl.
It is Carl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Nancy Miller, Citizen Review Board Director for the State Court Administrator's Office, and we're here just to talk to you very briefly about setting a collaborative context for Senate Bill 555. And to make a quick pitch to you that Representative Brzozinski has heard at great length in the Ways and Means Committee. And we know that this is not a Ways and Means Committee, but we do think that this committee is in a very unique position to understand all the context of what's going on for kids during this session. Since you heard Senate Bill 408, you're now hearing 555, you heard Senate Bill 60, our family court bill. The courts are a very key link in any local integration system, regardless of what you make it look like. We have very much appreciated the opportunity to participate in the 555 work group. And as you know, 555 really speaks to achieving outcomes that have to be measured. The courts also have a piece of that, and we need to be partners in implementing the reforms that you pass during this session. It's no secret to anybody on this committee that these families are hitting our court system often, all the way across that continuum. The courts can respond and be active partners with the innovations we have undertaken and plan to undertake in the future. We're here today to explain very briefly, we only want to take about 5 minutes of your time, our linkages to you and to ask for your support as you discuss these important issues in your caucuses. Again, you're in a unique position to know the substantive way that these reforms can actually play out to implement these pieces of legislation that you've heard. As you know, our Family Court Initiative seeks to integrate service delivery for families across a broad continuum. We have two pilot family court programs that have been very successful, one in Deschutes and one in Jackson County. We have a $2.8 million budget package attached to that to roll that out to 20 judicial districts. We have two in place now. 18 more will come on board. That's a key piece of our initiative because it really helps us to bring those service providers together, link those families to services that you'll be hearing about in the 555 discussion. And Carl Ward is with me today. He is the director of our Information Systems Division and wants to talk to you very briefly about our court technology piece and how that links to 555.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carl Ward. I'm the Information Technology Director for the Oregon Judicial Department. The Chief Justice's budget does contain a couple of technology-related policy packages that we believe relate to the successful implementation of Senate Bill 555. These policy initiatives are important because they will be key components in the successful measurement of outcomes. Citizen Review Board, trial courts, and family court information systems will provide an independent source of information. These information systems will be central partners in any state or local integration efforts. As these policy packages relate specifically to Senate Bill 555, we have one that is working under the name of the Integrated Justice Environment. We have one handout that describes that. Specifically, that will allow the courts to refresh their 10-year-old information systems to accommodate their changing business needs. You've heard family court mentioned today. I believe you have a handout in your packet that sort of describes what family courts are. That is a changing business model for courts and court information systems. Senate Bill 555 is, in fact, a changing business model that this committee is requesting or actually legislating for agencies to change their business practices. The integrated justice environment will enable courts to be responsive partners in any local integration efforts. It will support the identification and implementation of best practices in the courts, and it will help us help judges make better informed decisions rapidly and analytically by letting us put the information that judges need to make those decisions at their fingertips on the bench or in chambers. The other package is to modernize the Citizen Review Board scheduling and review systems to once again accommodate the changing business model, to update those information systems so that they're modern information systems, and perhaps most importantly, to allow Citizen Review Board to track and measure outcomes of the program. And with that, we appreciate your time, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
The one major budget item on OGIN is in the Judicial Department's budget, and I know they have that as a high priority.
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you. And again, we very much appreciate just being able to make this pitch to you because the substantive pieces of law are sometimes lost in the budget discussion. And again, we just think that this committee is in such a unique position to understand how we might be able to best help implement this. So we're just asking for your advocacy.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I would now invite Jean Phelps and Sue Miller. At all. And others? And obviously, committee, we're not going to work this bill today. We're still in the information gathering stage. But I do intend to bring it back for work session by the end of the week. And we will be here Friday for those who can make it. I'm sorry, but we've got too many bills. I just need a quorum. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Senator. We're very appreciative of being here and certainly appreciate being part of the Three Nickels. We've always felt the Relief Nursery as very much a part of a system of care for children and families, and so we recognize the recognition of that within this Senate bill. I will just quickly give you an overview of what Relief Nurseries are. They are a child abuse prevention program. They are an early intervention program. We have mental health services, special ed services, alcohol and drug services. It is a weaving of services of family support that are embedded within the community, supported by the community, helping be funded by the community to help with the health and safety of families. We've been around for a long time. We in Eugene and Springfield, but we have new replications in Cottage Grove, Salem, and Portland, which we're very proud of. We sit within a system because we deal, if you look at the risk factors, and certainly if you look at the third page where we have the relief nursery's risks identified, you'll see that the ages that we're talking about of the children and that the risks we're talking about with the families are those that concern us most when we talk about safety of children. And we intervene because people want us. They come in a voluntary way. The only part of the program that's not voluntary is when the courts mandate that families do come to the nursery through a parent training program that we have in collaboration with services to children and families. Otherwise, people are there because they ask to be there. We all are loaded with huge waiting lists. Our outreach list alone in Eugene has each of our three outreach workers have caseloads of over 70 of people that they're trying to get to. Each one of these families have young children who are asking for help. That's kind of crucial within a system because even if we have something existing, if we have something existing that people can't access, it's hard, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So we really have to look at capacity. But what it says is when families are in trouble and they are turning for some assistance, they can get home visitation, they can get an early childhood program, they can get multiple assists with their families on an individual basis based on their individual needs. And that's what we're about. Again, I don't want to get too specific about the program. You don't have time for that, but we will be willing to answer any questions. Sitting here with me is Sue Miller from Salem, where she'll be speaking just in a little bit, and Raphine Schultz from Cottage Grove, and they'll be speaking. Additionally, when I'm finished, it'll be fast, and when they're finished, Ray Brown, who's one of our fathers in our program and also one of our peer support interventionists, will be coming up to speak. And we've invited Judge Ann Aiken to speak, and also in the audience are Labor Representative Jack Roberts and a supporter of the Cottage Grove Nursery on the board, Marilyn Gulber, who will be, if you have any questions, will be here. So I'm going to stop except to tell you, again, that you've got information about the nurseries. Please, one of the things I think it's really important to understand is that it's not any one risk factor that brings a family to the nursery. It's a multiple risk factors that cause us real concern. And for that reason, we have multiple approaches to deal with each family. And any one of the parts of systems that aren't there causes other systems to be less effective. When Healthy Start people refer to us, we need to be there. When we have multiple births, people that have not had their first birth or are not touched by Healthy Start, we need to be there. So, again, it's a part of the system that's not duplicated. It's important to be there, and thank you for the opportunity of speaking.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Sue Miller. I'm the president of Family Building Blocks, which is the name we gave the Marion Polk County Relief Nursery, because those of you who know Marion and Polk counties know we have a large agricultural economy here, and anytime we talk about a nursery, everyone thinks we're talking about plants. Therefore, we came up with Family Building Blocks as an alternative to the Marion Polk Relief Nursery. There are three really brief points I'd like to make. First of all, it's important that you understand that relief nurseries are community-based programs. We are a 501c3. We have a very active board of 25 community representatives who cross the spectrum of people interested in young children. We also have made a real commitment to raising money in order to expand the program so we can serve more children and families. In fact, as legislation is written, we have requested that part of the legislation include a 25% match from local funds to match any state funds that relief nurseries would receive. We ask for that. We totally support that kind of matching approach to funding and believe maybe it's a good model to look at. So the community base is important for us. A second point I wanted to make is that we've been in existence for 2.5 years now, thanks to a federal grant, which the State Commission for Children and Families submitted on our behalf.
That is a 3-year federal grant which expires in October. It's because of that that we are very, very interested in receiving some state funding to replace the federal grant, which will go away. At the same time, we are totally committed to raising other money to serve more kids in our community. The third point I would make is, and Mr. Walker alluded to it also, but even with the budget which we have, and currently it's about a $300,000 annual budget, we are just hitting the tip of the iceberg. We have waiting lists for all three of our programs. We're trying to do what the Eugene model suggests, which is at least to get a home visit into the families to make sure that we don't have any real crisis situations that might erupt while they're on the waiting list. But while we're asking the state to replace the current level of federal funding, I also want you to know that that comes nowhere close to meeting the need that we are finding in Marion and Polk counties after only 2.5 years of existence. So those conclude my comments, and at the end I'd be happy to respond to questions also. Thank you.
We'll withhold questions until we hear from the entire panel.
Okay. My name is Joachim Schultz. I'm the executive director of the Fanconi Anemia Research Fund in Eugene, but I live in Cottage Grove. And I serve on the board of directors of the relief ministry there. In fact, I'm one of the instigators and of that program, and here's why. Some of you may know that a number of years ago we had a few very tragic, horrible incidences of child abuse in Cottage Grove. And as a result, fellow Rotarians and I got together and other members of the community, and we tried to figure out, how can we prevent this from happening again? What can we do as a community? So we did forum committees and studied the issue and learned all these things that you've learned about early prevention, and discovered the relief nursery right next door in Eugene, and decided this is what we need to have in Cottage Grove. And we took this to the community and met with just outstanding support. The composition of our board of directors is just one reflection of that. We have members all across the community, law enforcement, federal prosecutors on our board, lieutenant commander of our police force, the director of social work of the Sacred Heart Hospital, managers of the bank, well, and riffraff like myself. We received a federal startup grant. In addition, we received a very generous donation which allowed us to purchase a lot and set up a manufacturer site. And when the federal grant ran out, we were able to fund our program for 1 year with 100% privately raised funds. That is just an outstanding accomplishment for our community. And currently, we fund our program with private funds to the tune of about 60%. What I'm here to tell you now is, we can probably keep our program going, but we can't do it all on our own. We're a small rural community. Our hospital has just closed down. There are tremendous needs, and we need a partnership. We need a private-public partnership. We believe we can hold up our end of things, and we've done a great job of that, and we can provide the site, and we can match funds, but we will need additional support. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
I'd like to introduce Ray Brown, who is from the Lane County program in Eugene and is a parent and now a peer support person.
Ray? Thank you. Good afternoon. I've worked at the Relief Nursery for about 4.5 years now, doing the peer support and alcohol and drug program. I was introduced to the program at the Relief Nursery after getting out of my fifth A&D treatment program, where I had just gotten custody of my 3 children and really couldn't find one specific place to go get services. I'd heard about the Relief Nursery as it being a voluntary service, which I hadn't heard of, and I was mandated to services for 14 years of my life, so when I heard of a voluntary service, it got my attention. And what I liked about the Relief Nursery is that it was a continuum of services that worked for my whole family. Not only was my children getting early intervention, I was getting parenting skills as well as recovery help, support individually as well as in groups. I got transportation and different things that were very essential that I didn't have at the time. What's nice about working at the Relief Nursery is I'm able to offer those services to families, to the entire family, as well as see them grow through these mandated services that are required upon families today. That was about all. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Ann Aiken. I'm a resident of Lane County, and I've served on the Relief Nursery Board for almost 11 years. I've had the capacity of a juvenile judge in our county for 2 years before I have my current position on the federal bench. I served as a family lawyer and a judge of general jurisdiction on the circuit court for over 10 years. This is a gap in the system of delivery that is so critical that needs to be filled, that I'm very, very pleased that for the first time we're really addressing it. I had the privilege of serving on the Governor's Commission on Juvenile Justice many years ago, and we built prisons for adolescents instead of addressing early intervention needs, and it was a crying need at that point, and very sad that we could not get the focus on addressing the numbers, the large numbers of children in abuse and neglect situations, not only not in CSD or SCF jurisdiction, but within the community. The partnership Eugene has had with the business community, with law enforcement, with the medical community, and with the bench has been astronomical, and our program really stands as a model because we can respond to community needs and the vast array of services that, that families need in a moment, in moments of crisis. And if you look at the cost savings, they're on the back of the kind of cream-colored page. That doesn't even begin to add what I spend every day in the courtroom on federal prison beds. And having been a person who's read pre-sentence reports at the state level and at the federal level, it doesn't take a rocket scientist very long to figure out that you can identify these kids with their family backgrounds, either when they're little and address them and make a difference with their programs, or you can wait and spend very, very expensive dollars on federal prison beds or state beds. The nursery has been, for me, a mental health break to know I have a place where I can refer folks who have comprehensive service delivery and will not be set up for failure. And more importantly, what's hard from a public policy standpoint, as a parent of five children, when my children were born, I decided that I wanted to invest in my children, and I bought them shoes, I got them health care, I got them activities, I spent time with them, I loved them. My husband and I shared in that responsibility. We fed them, we met their needs, and we invested in them, and they went to school ready to learn. The public policy of the state of Oregon needs to take that proactive approach and look at intervening at high-risk families that are not able to provide those services for their children. It's a big gap in our system, and it's smart public policy, and it will, down the road, make a huge difference in the numbers of children coming into the juvenile justice system, into the state correction system, and then on into our deluxe, most expensive system, and that is the federal prison system. So I am very, very pleased that we're talking about early intervention in a systematic, continuum of care approach, because down the road, you will be state-of-the-art in terms of where this field needs to be and where it's headed. Thank you for having us.
And just, I'm curious about what the cost is for the Cadillac federal system on a prisoner. For our Department of Corrections, it's about $20,000. For Oregon Youth Authority, it's about $45,000.
Oh, I know. I'll get you the exact number. I'd be happy to do
that.
Oh, I think they're substantially greater. I'd be happy to provide that information to you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Yes,
Senator.
When you talk about intervention, what difficulties do you find? I mean, you can identify these children. When you try to intervene, do you have trouble with parents, or do you usually find willing parents, or how do you get to the point where, in a practical viewpoint, you actually get your programs working?
The nursery is very good about building up trust and working with families and looking at what they need, and over time, getting people to talk to you. And I have watched that in the courtroom when cases that are brought to court, and some the nursery cases aren't often brought to court, but they're crossover cases. And really, it's people and families are complicated. It takes time to earn their respect and trust. It takes a great deal of energy to figure out what moves them, what they see as their issues, what you see from the outside of their issues. And I guess from a standpoint of looking at a system, when you have a baby, you go home from the hospital with the baby, and the state doesn't really have a right to intervene in that baby's life until they go to, you know, kindergarten, Head Start, or school. So all that period of time, no one's involved in that family's life, and if there's crisis, the first time we really know about it is when there's an injury to a child or a neglect report or, you know, something more dramatic, child is killed or sexually assaulted. What the nursery does is give us a chance to identify those families from risk factors ahead of time, and it gives the chance for the families to intervene with a supportive system to provide all those. Jean, you probably want to.
I just have a quick thing to say. Senator Nelson, one of the things that we found is that we don't try to pre-guess what people want. Often what they want is a word of encouragement. Often what they want is somebody immediately at the home. Sometimes they want a minute of rest, an hour of rest. What we found that made a big difference. Another one, the one I saw on the phone today was a pediatrician who called in because the mother was just diagnosed with cancer. She's going to want a lot more help. You never can tell what a family's need. What you need to be is prepared for whatever they come to you with and use that front moment to be able to get in, build trust, and then take longer time to make real changes.
And the other piece is these children, as you look at the brain research and the massive amounts of data out there that tell us so much is formed in those first 0 to 3, then 3 to 6 years, these children who are high-risk children have a therapeutic preschool that gives them the kind of stimulation that gives them an opportunity to go to school ready to learn. And we can't look past that research and how critical it is to get to those kids who are in high-risk situations between 0 to 6.
Well, is that the $17,000 figure on the Head Start program that we're talking about?
No.
What are the figures? How many children are we talking about in this whole thing?
On the Head Start?
We're talking children at risk from that age group 0 to 6. Is anybody can
well, how many there are?
Yeah.
Well, let's see.
There are 900,000. There were, in one of the last studies we looked at, 900,000 children 18 and under. That's when we were looking at Measure 11 issues, and at that point, as I recall, in our legislative and our judicial task force, there were 1,800 violent juvenile centers that drove that debate of the 900 children in Oregon. So if you even divide that in half, that's 450,000.
Well, if you apply Dr. Walker's number of 6 to 9% have some need in that range, you're talking about...
That's early children. I mean, we're talking 600,000 children in our school system, aren't we?
That's right.
That's K through 12.
K through 12.
So I was just trying to get a feel for how many children are we really talking about.
I think the 900,000 is...
0 to 18. So that makes sense. If it's 600 that are kindergarten through, then that leaves about 450,400.
Senator
Carno. I'm kind of curious, because in your documents you talk about putting the children through an assessment. They're assessed as they come into the system. And if those children who need additional help are given one-to-one counseling, how receptive are the parents when you bring this issue to the parents of the child? How receptive are they to the fact that you folks are recommending or giving additional counseling to the child?
One of the things that we found is by having so much of these different systems, or actually state systems, but they're embedded within an early intervention program, we do not find resistance. We find people who are asking for the help that we, you know, our capacity doesn't allow us completely to provide, but we do not find resistance. And I think it's the way we go into it initially. These are people that are not forced to be in a program. These are people who want to be in a program. There are those times, certainly, Senator Tarno, when you would find some resistance. We find, and that's one of the reasons we like it embedded, because if somebody is so resistant that they don't want their child, and you do find that every once in a while, not to be able to get counseling, the counselors are there. So what they do is they assist those people that are seeing the family, if the teachers, Ray, who does the support work, they'll work with them to help them get to the issues with the family so that we have ways of getting to the family. If they say no to a formal counselor, they're getting some counseling assistance through their teachers because the teachers are working with the counselors. So it's a way of getting to them. Also, I might want to mention the alcohol and drug program has been outside researched, and I don't know of any other alcohol and drug recovery prevention and treatment program is embedded within an early intervention program. I think it's been very successful.
Yes.
Ask a question?
Yes, you may.
Thanks.
The question that I have had to do with the appropriateness, you think, of the relief nursery models in the various size communities that we have in Oregon, and how large does the population have to be before the model that you have is appropriate, or sort of give me an idea of what your thinking is about that.
Representative Pearson, first of all, thank you for your question. As Yaheem had mentioned, Cottage Grove, can I tell you how many, Yaheem?
8,000.
So it's very successful in that community. We never take our model and set it somewhere. We've always waited for people to come to us to ask, because it's when the community is ready that it's going to be the most successful. So any community of any size. We've also worked with the tribal population of Clabba and found that was even a smaller population, and actually the program that was set up there was very, very successful. It's not the numbers, it's the motivation of the community to want to make change.
And in Portland, we're working with, there's another organization that's come together to move nurseries into smaller communities in Portland and approach the city of Portland and the outlying areas as communities, smaller communities within the city. So they're examining how to pick and choose where it needs to grow in Portland.
Yes, for picking.
So how far are they in that process, and what is that? Can you give me some indication of how that's working and what it looks like in the Portland area? That's really interesting to me.
There are two. One of them is currently underway. It's been since early 90s. That's a program that we would like to see grow. It's right now, in fact, we've insisted now that they add a higher degree of private support, but they have been successfully working with a certain numbers there. We were very excited by a second Portland program that came in through the corrections piece, through a program called Pathfinders, and they found that there was a hole in their system, that as the correction population was coming into the community, they weren't getting appropriate support for their families and for the recovery issues. And so that's when they turned to us and said, this is what we want. We want to embed it within the corrections population. We want to add the alcohol and drug piece and the early intervention piece, and they're starting a second program.
So.
I appreciate your comments, because I think what you point out is not only does the community need to be asking and wanting this kind of program, but that there isn't one size fits all or one type of nursery that fits every community, that this is an individual community response and request. And
we don't own any of them, and as you'll note, nobody has the same name.
the other piece is it's all premised on research and data that we not only use the historical, the 20 years of research in this field and beyond, but we also build within each other what works with each community and what we can take and share back and forth. And so it's been really a wonderful exercise in learning about other communities and learning how they've approached and given us the chance to do some things differently as well.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'd invite Peggy Pearson and Gloria Griffith, please.
Mr. Chair and committee, thank you very much for letting us come here today. My name is Gloria Griffith. I work, I live and I work in Springfield, Oregon. I'm the Family Resource Center Project Coordinator for the Springfield Schools in the Marcola School District. And I'm also a parent of two children in middle school, Briggs Middle School in Springfield. And, you know, as a parent, I've always been surprised at the effort that was made to get me into the schools. Usually it was either for an open house, it might be for a PTA meeting, or maybe, and most often when not that my children ever get into trouble, but it seems like that's quite often when we do invite parents to come into schools. Family resource centers are sort of the new kids on the block. We're still learning how to advocate for ourselves and help people understand who we are and what we do. Quickly, a family resource center considers parents as their first and most important teacher, and also as the community's best resource about the children. Family resource centers emphasize family strength. They work with families within the context of their school and community environment. Family resource centers allow informal one-on-one contact between parents and school staff. They serve as a place for parents to practice new parenting skills or job skills. They provide a a compiling of resources between schools and communities to support families. They give parents the opportunity to meet other parents to break down isolation, and it also and family resource centers also offer parent education, workshops, and other resources on child development, parenting, or other interests of those parents. In the network of family resource centers that we have in Springfield, you can walk into any one of those 9 schools that have family resource centers, and there's a big sign there that says families are welcome in these schools. We know research shows that children who have families who are engaged in their education do better in school. We've lost that connection over the years. We need to get parents involved early on in family resource centers. They're a perfect place to invite those families that have children 0 to 5 into the schools. It was mentioned earlier that some parents have had very negative experiences with schools when they were younger. One parent in particular that I talked to just the other day said that when her child started 2 years ago at that particular school, she was ready for a battle. She remembered how her mother felt about public schools, and she didn't have a good experience herself in school. She said, "I was ready for a battle." Said a couple days later, I got invited to come into the Family Resource Center. They gave me a cup of coffee, a muffin. I felt at home in this room. I started to get to know the staff. The principal even walked in one day and said, "Hi," shook my hand and wanted to know who I was. And for some parents, that's a pretty exciting thing, because usually it was the principal going like this. She now is a volunteer at the school, applying for several jobs within the Springfield School District in their printing shop, and that she feels like had the family center not been there at that time when her child first started the school, she may not have been the advocate that she is right now. She communicates with her teachers often. The point that I'd like to make is that family resource centers do provide a place for parents to be. They make connections with the community. I handed out my brochure. That's a very parent-friendly brochure, I think, and that's how it was developed. Also, I gave you the year-end report for 1997-98. That was a school year report. It gives you some numbers, shows some of the collaborations that we have. We are working with our community. I know people say, "Oh, that Springfield, Eugene area, they're rich in social services." Bottom line is, most of those social services in Eugene, Springfield families, like many rural families, don't feel real comfortable going into bigger towns. And to us, even now, myself, Eugene, I come to Salem, it's like a big trip for me. But going to Eugene, it's like, you know, going over that bridge. Some parents actually, I think, they think they need some sort of a passport to get into Eugene. So to always access services there is very difficult. It's very respectful when those services do come across the bridge to our families, and family resource centers offer that avenue for social services to provide more of their services to families within the school context. Peggy?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Peggy Perkerson, and I am currently the director of the Hart Family Resource Center in Harrisburg. Just a tiny bit about myself, because I'm not used to doing this, even though in position of this job I've been up here, this is my third time, and I'm still just as nervous. I am a resident of rural Lynn County and have been for 23 years, and out of that, 17 of those years, I was a stay-at-home mom. I know what it's like to live at home with small children, be isolated, and be at home with little kids and not know anybody and have no place to go. When my youngest child, who is legally blind, by the way, was 10 years old, which also was one of the reasons why I stayed home as long as I did, I went back to school to earn my degree. I graduated from the University of Oregon in 1995, and my focus of my senior research thesis was revitalizing the sense of community and connecting people back with each other, their neighbors, their community, and ultimately their government. I found family resource centers to be a perfect match of all those things that I hold dear: families, kids, parents, neighbors, communities, and schools. Let me tell you about my experience with family resource centers. I've been a family resource center for Lanain County, which is how I know Gloria. I drove 35 miles one way to start up the family resource center in Veneta, which is another small rural town in West Lane County. I am currently now in Harrisburg, which is another small rural town in southern Lynn County. These towns are very similar in size, but they are not similar in needs, and that is one thing that's very unique to family resource centers, and I also heard in relief nurseries. They are built from the ground up. They have local boards. They have local volunteers. We look at the issues in the community in which we are housed and find out what's really needed there.
They are open to everyone. They are non-stigmatizing and non-threatening. That is one thing that is really unique and very difficult, as Gloria said, advocating for family resource centers, is that there's no income criteria, there's no age criteria, there's no race, ethnicity, name it, whatever else governments have always imposed on families. Some of the first questions I get is, can anybody come in here? Is this for me? My kid is such and such age, or I make such and such of money, or whatever. No, it's for everyone. One of the things that's unique in my community is that there was no preschool. There is no Head Start. So we are sometimes, for most families, 18 right now that are currently in our co-op preschool, because we do believe parents need to be involved in their children's lives. So they do volunteer several times in the term with their children in the classroom. We have parent-child play groups for parents birth to five, which is just a drop-in center, which is something we didn't have when my kids were young, and I would have really appreciated that. We are a community-based center. We are not in a school. Harrisburg schools don't have any room for us, and so we are out in the community. But we've used our resources, both financial and others, to provide the Second Steps Violence Prevention curriculum, which Hill Walker was talking about in the first testimony. This is a prevention curriculum that is taught in the schools, like you mentioned. The school, I have talked to them, and they are saying it's working wonderful, and we're looking at implementing it for the middle school next year. We've partnered with Northwest Medical Teams, who have been in the news lately with the Kosovo crisis, but they also run a rural health plan, and they run rural dental care. And we have been successful in bringing them to Harrisburg twice this year to provide free dental care for kids, which is a service that was not even otherwise known or even accessed by this community before. And this is for children who are not available for the Oregon Health Plan or have outside insurance. I could go on and tell you about all the wonderful things we're doing in the community and all the resources that we've brought to Harrisburg that were not there before, and how we connect with families. And I think that that's probably the most important thing, is the family stories. There's Matt, who's a 13-year-old boy who comes to our after-school program, because unlike Gloria, we do run, I don't know exactly what all the things that you do, because they're changing all the time, because families' needs change. We are open 4 days a week till 6 o'clock to provide a safe place for kids to go after school, because that was something that the community was saying they needed. I've been working with our local district judge, Judge Lemhouse, and he has repeatedly said this was something that we needed in our community. So we run an after-school program, and we've gotten grants from Hewlett-Packard and USF to get free computers, Internet access. We have after-school homework help and lots of things that kids like to do, puzzles and games and beating and computer games and computer help. Matt is in our after-school program. He lives out in the country, and he is one of the children that the families that we staffed at the youth services team. I don't know if you're familiar with YSTs, but they're one more component of family centers in our community that I sit on, and it's a multi-agency group of people that get together and do intervention with families that are enrolled in school. And his mom was looking for a safe, structured place for him to be after school. She didn't want him home alone. So his mom, who works till 5:30, is grateful that he has a safe place to be after school, and he's grateful to have a place where he can come play his computer games and hang out with his friends. And then there's Jackie and her 5-year-old daughter, Amanda, who had just been diagnosed with juvenile diabetes. And Jackie would come and visit the center while her daughter was in our co-op preschool and search the Internet for information for her family. And she also said to tell me that she came down to get free glasses, to find out about the Lions Club's program to get glasses for her first grade son, who just needed a pair of glasses. She said, be sure to tell them about that, too. And then there's Jenna and Tristan. And Jenna moved to Harrisburg in July and didn't know anybody in town. She was a toddler, isolated and alone, which is something that I knew about. Began bringing Tristan to our parent-child playgroup, which is a drop-in activity for children with parents birth to five. She immediately connected with other young families in the community to begin sharing information on babysitters, school systems, and various joys and struggles of parenting. She wanted to give back to the community so much that she had received that she had became our first Healthy Start volunteer in the Harrisburg area. 7 months later, now she's one of our biggest volunteers and a newest member of my board of directors, and the city of Harrisburg has just asked her to be on her budget committee.
to me, her story gets to the heart of family resource centers and also to what I guess I was speaking to when I wrote my senior thesis, that it puts in practice the connections of getting people connected back with their neighborhoods. The family resource center's open and not non-threatening, family-friendly environment connects families of all ages, income, ethnicity with each other and their community. And like Gloria said, we recognize parents as the primary and most important teacher in a child's life, that we hold to the principles that all families have the ability to change for the better if given the right support and services in their own community. Healthier and safe communities where neighbors know each other and know each other's kids is what family resource centers are all about. And thank you for your time.
Thank you for your volunteer and your enthusiasm. Committee, I'm going to ask you not to ask questions because we're behind schedule. And I need to move ahead with Steve Marks and Pam Curtis, Randy Frankie, and Scott Johnson. I've been advised by Mr. Chandler the work group's going to meet tonight again at 6 o'clock. So,
Chair, members of the committee, we've been at 12 and went to 2:30, and I think we need about a half hour to finish up. You're all welcome to come
they
by.
They don't need to bring sleeping bags.
No sleeping bags. In fact, I think the one thing that convinced me not to stay too long, we wanted me to buy pizza and throw them on the sheet. So.
And, committee, I do want to assure you we are going to go through these other bills that are on the agenda, too. There's only one that will take a little time. Good afternoon. Who would like to brief us?
For the record, Mr. Chair, Steve Marks, Governor's Senior Policy Advisor. I just would like to say how much we appreciate the opportunity this committee has provided in allowing us to negotiate through the amendments. I think we've done a whole lot of heavy lifting and have much more agreement there than disagreement. There are a few issues that we feel we need to go through tonight to clarify, and those are I think, becoming more and more readily apparent, and there are just are not that many issues left. I want to just say for the record that mandating Healthy Start going statewide is a fatal flaw from our point of view, but we also believe there's some accommodation and way to look at the budget to look at Healthy Start overall, but mandating it in the policy of the legislation would be difficult for us. I don't want to make this sound negative because it's not. Short of that issue, I think we're doing an outstanding job, and I just let others reflect their comment.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Randy Frankie, Marion County Commissioner, and I represent the local Coalition of Children and Families Commission in this discussion and negotiation process. I would just say that I think we've made extremely good progress in coming to areas where we can agree and changing the language, and I would say from our perspective, and it's for some of you may know, for us it's difficult. We've got 36 different children and families commissions around the state, and the directors all feel very strongly that they don't speak for the local commission until they've had a chance to talk to the local commission and those citizens tell them what they think of these things. So for us, it's we need a little more lead time going back and forth to get the feedback from our local coalition members into us. But we think we've made very good progress. Folks have worked over the weekends reading the bills and trying to get input to us. And when we come to the table, I think we've been received very well. And as an example today, I think 90% of the issues we brought were accepted and included in the redraft. And we're excited about the 6 o'clock meeting tonight. Hope to wrap more of this up.
Well, we appreciate your hard work. Where is the 6 o'clock meeting going to be?
In the Republican caucus room.
Okay, good to know where that is. And I had a request that there's some group that meets Friday morning, group of counties.
Yeah, it's the AOC, Human Service and Public Safety Steering Committee.
And they have, by then, we'll probably have a dash 10 amendments that they'd like an opportunity to review it before we pass it out of a work group. And I'm certainly willing to do that. Committee, this is one that has the importance that we better do it right, because the idea is that it will go down to Ways and Means, and then it'll come back to the floor for a vote, so it won't go through a House Substance Committee. So it's we'll give it a little extra time if we need to do that. Pam or Scott, is there anything you'd like to add? Well, thanks for your hard work, and good luck. It saves the committee a lot of time when you do this.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay. So that will close then the hearing on Senate Bill 555. And Kitty and Floyd, you're welcome to stay, but thank you for being here, and please give us your input.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I was here also for 942. Can you just tell me when you're planning on doing
that? Okay. And I think we have 942. We've got consensus, correct?
Yeah. I'm not sure about our leaving.
I can add something.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, 942. I'll open then. It's a public hearing, Mr. Chairman of the committee. This bill came over from another committee. There are -1 and -2 amendments. Mark Gardner proposed the -1 amendments. He's here. He's asked to withdraw the -1 amendments.
The -2
amendments come from Francis Baker, and they are of a technical nature, and we got them just before the meeting. She is familiar with them. She can explain them to you.
Francis, would you come forward? I'd also invite Lisa Nato and someone from Lane County, right?
Chairman.
Welcome. And John Bradley and Mark Gardner.
And Kathy, if you could call Senator Farioli's office in about 10 minutes, we'll be ready. Good afternoon. Who would like to begin?
Did you want me to address the amendment, Carl?
Yes, why don't we do that? All right. Yeah, we're in agreement that we're going to be working off those amendments from the group. All right.
I'm Frances Baker. I'm the project coordinator of the Effective Incarceration Project, which was behind this bill. The amendments that you have in front of you are ones that after 10 months of working on the bill and finally getting it into what we thought was perfect form and submitting it to legislative council, after it was printed, our committee looked at it and said, oh, wait, we forgot some things. So these are not substantive. They're more things we sort of neglected to put in there because we assumed that they would be known, things such as an age limit. This is not a program for juveniles at this point, so we needed to put the 18-year limit. We needed to make sure it was clear that for Lane County, where there is a diversion program, we included people who simply had a charge as opposed to a conviction, because that's the way they operate in Lane County. After months of working on lines 20 through 26 on page 3, that's the section that dealt with warrants from other counties, after finessing that language for 10 months after it was printed, we suddenly looked at it and realized there was nothing a judge could do with someone who had a warrant from another county other than send them back. So we deleted that in its entirety. That may be the only substantive one here, and there's no opposition to any of the amendments. And I'd now like to turn it over to Mark Gardner to discuss the bill and how we got here.
Mark. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Gardner. I'm special counsel to the Attorney General, and I had the great pleasure to be the co-chair of the Effective Incarceration Project's task force that worked on this particular issue. I'm going to be extremely brief. It's late in the day, and I'm going to try to do this in 3 minutes or less. Basically, this is a bill that would set up two pilot programs, one in Lane County, one in Deschutes County, that would set up an intensive non-custodial probation or diversion program for people with mental illness. In my experiences in my former life as a circuit court judge, I can tell you that these people cycle through the criminal justice system almost like some people do their wash. In a survey that was done in August of 1998, and I've got the figures here, probably about 70% of the people that entered the jails in the counties that were surveyed, on average, had been in the jail before These are people with mental illnesses. And this is an attempt to put some money, I guess, in the front end of when these people are convicted for crimes that probation would be the appropriate sentence, or where they could be diverted out of the criminal justice system, to give them the resources and the intensive management and help with housing and other services so that they would not come back into the program. It's patterned after a program in Wisconsin that has a recidivism rate of less than 10%. And so if it works, and we believe that it will work, it will, in fact, save the state significant amounts of money as far as correctional services are concerned. There are other parts of the bill that require statistics to be kept, reporting back to the legislature about the effectiveness of the program. And as I said, it's a pilot program that's set up for 2.5 years to see if it would work. It's going to cost the state about $3 million in general funds. And there would be another $2 million of federal funds that would go into the program. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
And because of that financial impact, this one, it would go to Ways and Means if the committee approves it. Before we open up for questions, why don't we allow the others to speak?
If I could speak very briefly as to what's being handed out, that the packet that I put together for you, it contains a copy of Mark's statement. It also contains an article by the National Institute of Justice highlighting the program in Milwaukee, Wisconsin that this is modeled after. It also contains an article, a recent study showing the cost effectiveness in terms of jail costs, law enforcement costs, et cetera, of having community, intensive community mental health treatment after a person is released from jail. I believe you also have what you may have already received, two copies of two letters, one from co-chair Frank Bearden, who regrets that he couldn't be here, but he's on the bench today, and also a letter from Representative Lane Shetterly.
Sure. Thank you, Senator and members of the committee. Lisa Nato, Multnomah County Commissioner, and I'm here to testify in favor of this bill and would also like your advocacy and support for it and for the mentally ill in our community. I first really became aware of this problem when I was a deputy district attorney and doing arraignment. And I arraigned a person coming out of Rocky Butte Jail who was in custody on a trespass charge. I looked at the date of the arrest, and it had been 60 days prior to the time of arraignment, and law required that you're arraigned within 24 hours. I asked what had happened, and it turned out he'd been held in Rocky Butte Jail for 60 days on a charge, but the maximum penalty was 30 days in jail. They had lost his paperwork, and he hadn't thought to ask. And so I immediately dismissed the charge and was under the instructions of my trunk, and no doubt the fellow was released and right back and wanted right back to the Greyhound station. Upon becoming a county commissioner and touring the jails, I was instructed by our health department that we were holding people in our jails who had been mandated pre-trial for evaluation and treatment at the state hospital, but there was no room at the state hospital, so we were holding them in jail without, of course, the legal ability to afford treatment, which is probably a good thing. But nonetheless, this was a problem throughout the state. I raised the matter to the governor, met with Barry Katz, and the E-Board took the leadership and initiative and opened another unit at the state hospital. So that problem has been resolved. But I want to describe to you some people for whom jail is not a meaningful sanction, but another confusing and disorienting experience in their life. A group of people to whom the criminal justice system is an expensive situation and it has no real impact on changing their behavior and, in fact, may lead to increased homelessness and exacerbate the manifestations of this disease. I'm going to describe a person to you that I know very well. He is a multiple felon. He is overweight. He is unkempt. He's usually very disoriented in his speech. And if you saw him on the street, you would shun him. Now that you've probably formed a kind of opinion in your own mind of what this negative impression of what he is like, I'd like to describe to you some of the experiences that I have witnessed with him over the years. He comes from an upper middle class family in a small town in Oregon. Both his parents were teachers. I know you've just had a lot of testimony on 555 and early childhood, but I'd like you to know that all of his siblings were successful students and have gone on to successful careers. So don't look for a cause in this. This is an illness we're talking about. There were signs in kindergarten. His drawings were a little odd. There was a shoplifting charge when he was young. and he took LSD when he was 13 years old. In his teen years, he hitchhiked around the country, and at one point showed up at his sibling's dorm covered with ticks, more than 100 ticks all over his body from sleeping out in pastures. His first felony charge that I'm aware of was in his 20s. He was growing pot plants in his room in a small coastal town in Oregon, and it was told to him that the case would be dismissed if he left town, which he did. So now, fast forward several years, he's now an adult, and he was stopped by, and I'm reading the police report, he was driving a car, he had picked up a couple African-American men in North Portland, where he was living at the time. He was stopped for failing to signal for 100 consecutive feet before making a left-hand turn. At that time, he was stopped, and they said his speech was slurred, and they asked him to perform field sobriety tests. He did perform those tests, and he passed. He was not under the influence of anything. But they asked if they could search him. He says he did not give consent, but the police report said that he did. They found a pipe, and there was ash in the pipe. The ash was sent to the lab, and there was residue of cocaine in the ash, and he was charged with a felony count. He then pled to that charge. And during this time, he had spent some time in jail on the charge. There were probably some failures to appear. It's just unclear to really get a handle on what exactly happened throughout this time. But at some point, there was a charge, and he was put on probation. And then during the probation charge, he would fail to appear occasionally, and it was probably not going to his alcohol and drug treatment, although when family members tried to verify if he was going as he said he was, they would say they couldn't even release under confidentiality rules whether or not he was in fact a client at that facility. So there was really no way for family to help him at all. When he was picked up on the probation violation charge, again, another attorney, another court date, another prosecutor involved, everyone came to an agreement that he be continued on probation under some new conditions, and then it was found out that he had another hold in another county on a shoplifting charge of shoplifting men's cologne in a store. So he had to remain in jail, sent to that county, again wait, and was held in custody for probably about 2 weeks before that probation violation came up. And again, it was continued on the same terms as in the other county. But meanwhile, he'd been spending that time in jail. Now he's faced with a new felony charge. There was an altercation over about 10 pop cans. According to police reports, the accused claimed they were his, the other person claimed they were his, and there was allocation of shoving both ways, which does lead to a felony count. This person that I know well is very lucky in some ways. He has parents, although they're in their 70s, they've tried to help him keep track of his appointments, go to court dates. They've made sure that his rent is paid on his dilapidated trailer home, and so he does have a place to live, unlike many of the people that get recycled in and out of the system in these types of charges. But let me tell you a few good things about him. He's never hurt anyone, although I've seen him beat up several times. He has a sense of humor. He takes care of stray animals, and he's really a very kind person. He's not the person that we should be spending our money on in the criminal justice system. He needs to have assistance in getting through his daily life and treatment for his drug and alcohol problems. And so I urge you, as the Judiciary Committee, to look at this population, which is not able to speak for themselves, that are now in our jail system rotating in and out, and please step up in a leadership role to do something about this. Thank you.
Okay, earlier we heard from the Direction of Drug Corrections. I think that the number of mentally ill prisoners he has is increasing. Where it was 13 or 14% is going now up to a range of about 18%, which is substantial. Who'd like to go next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Sherman. I'm currently employed by Lane County Sheriff's Office as the mental health supervisor, although I am not here on behalf of Lane County Sheriff or Lane County. I have over 15 years of experience working with incarcerated persons who are mentally ill. I'm also the principal investigator on a federally funded research project in Lane County, which is studying the effectiveness of diverting persons with mental illness and co-occurring substance abuse disorders from the criminal justice system. I am a consultant to the National Institute of Corrections in the Federal Department of Justice regarding mental health services in jails. And I have worked closely with the State Sheriff's Association, Oregon Jail Managers, and the Mental Health Division over the years to address many issues associated with the mentally ill population in Oregon jails. I come before you with a solid and informed perspective on the issues that Senate Bill 942 attempts to address. This perspective is not limited to just Lane County, but encompasses statewide, national, and research-based information. As you undoubtedly know, the criminal justice system has experienced explosive growth over the last decade. Nearly 1.6 million individuals currently are incarcerated in our nation's jails and prisons. This represents an increase of 113% since 1985. Another 4 million persons are on parole and probation. All told, 3% of the nation's adult population are under some form of correctional supervision. This growing correctional population includes increasing numbers of individuals with special treatment needs. Approximately 9.8 million people are booked into our nation's 3,300 jails every year. Clinical studies, as well as our own research, suggest that between 6 and 15% of these annual admissions have acute and serious mental illnesses, including schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and unipolar depression. Beginning with Senator Robert F. Kennedy's 1965 crusade against the so-called state pit, the institutions for mentally ill and the mentally retarded have come under very close scrutiny, which has generated demand for change. Hospitals have closed in favor of community-based treatment models. Between 1955 and 1994, 91% of the nation's state psychiatric hospital beds have been eliminated. The majority of these hospital closures have occurred in the last decade, with at least 44 hospitals closing between 1990 and 1998. Oregon's own hospital bed situation has followed this national trend. There is no doubt that community-based treatment does work, and it is more humane when there is enough resources available. It is also cheaper than jail. The problem is that there is not nearly enough community resource available, and the promise of integrated community services to treat this population has never materialized. So they end up in jail. Approximately 40% of all individuals with severe mental illness are not receiving treatment at any given time. Once a mentally ill person gets into jail, they have a constitutional right to treatment. And if they refuse that treatment and are psychotic, they are typically found to be unfit to proceed with their criminal charges and ordered into the care of Oregon State Hospital. Once stabilized, they return to the jail to face criminal prosecution. Eventually, they are released from custody, and if we fail to provide them with appropriate treatment and services, they decompensate, again becoming psychotic, and the cycle begins all over again. Imagine the expense, if you will, please, of police officers arresting these folks, booking them into the jail, them being attended to by medical and mental health staff, seeing them in the jail, the court costs, the attorney fees, transporting expenses to the hospital, care and treatment in the hospital, transporting them back to the jail, the subsequent court costs, the subsequent jail costs, and then kicking them out on the street to start that cycle all over again. And while the individual is in custody, federal Medicaid resources are not available to even pay for their psychiatric care. We cannot afford to continue this cycle. In addition to these material costs, there is a heavy price that the community pays in terms of public safety and quality of life issues for the community. There is no need for this intolerable situation to continue. There are models of care that work well with this seriously ill population. These models include comprehensive and integrated services that are tailored to the needs of the individual. The pilot programs proposed in Senate Bill 942 provide this type of integrated service. Based on the successful model employed in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin Community Support Program, these programs will offer the comprehensive array of services needed to maintain seriously ill persons in the community and keep them out of our criminal justice system. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Justin. Good afternoon. If you could pull the mic and move your chair a little bit.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, my name is John Bradley. I'm a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County, and I'm here speaking for Mike Schrunk, the district attorney. I think one of the important things, and maybe we haven't emphasized this enough, is that we took 15 months to put this together. And in that 15-month period, we heard testimony from various experts throughout the country. And I guess one of the most disturbing things we learned is the facility that houses more mentally ill people than any other place in the country, and you've probably learned it, is the L.A. County Jail. I've been a prosecutor a long, long time. In fact, is we're now hiring people who weren't even born when I was a prosecutor. It's that long. But in that time, we have seen a complete lack of ability to do anything with people who have serious mental problems. And and I'm not talking about the very, very serious charges where people, murder people rape people. I'm talking about, if you want to call it, the quality of life crimes. And those are the things that, unless you can catch that person in the courtroom and have somebody take that person to a program and then have something over that person's head, there's not much that you can do with it. Multnomah County tried a year or two ago to implement a triage program where we'd try to evaluate who we thought we could put into some type of diversion plan. And I think out of the many, many people we looked at, we concluded that maybe there were four. And of those four, none of them showed up to where they were supposed to be, and ultimately the whole program failed. And what we have heard time and time again during the course of this 15 months is that one of the most important things is that these people have to have places to go, people to monitor them. And if they don't have housing, if they don't have the follow-up, then all the money you're spending at the front end, you're losing at the back end, and they're going to come back. The other thing I'd like to say is this. I think this is something that we all support. Both the prosecution, there was somebody from the U.S. Attorney's Office who every time he showed up, he disavowed his association with the U.S. Attorney's Office, but nonetheless participated. But the Public Defender's Office, a whole host of people from mental health. And I think one of the things is that the product you see before you is something in which we all agree, because we think, based upon what other communities have done, it's something that can and will work. And it is a pilot project. And the district attorneys, we've talked to the district attorneys in the counties where these projects are going to be, Lane County and Schuch County. They support the idea. They say they need the funding, obviously. But it's something that in 2 years, the legislature will be able to look at it and decide, do these things make sense? Are these things cost effective? And it's going to cost, $3 million ultimately? But I think the cost in the long run, the people of the state, both at the state level, the county level, and the local level, you're going to save money in the long run. And we ask you to support it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm here today as a member of the work group that has been working on for 15 months. Myself and Representative Shetterly worked with the group as much as we could on a monthly basis. Everyone here has participated with the exception of Commissioner Nato, but I really appreciate her being here to give us her perspective. I agree with Mr. Bradley. As John says, from the prosecuting side, this is really a win-win, because what we need to do is get these individuals out of the system once and for all. And the way that we need to be able to do that is have the care available and the treatment and the resources to make certain that they are getting their daily needs met and they're not finding themselves forced into a criminal justice system because of acting out and not being able to take care of themselves or receiving the medication they need. I think it's real important for you to understand that this is a pilot program for the two counties. The reason these two counties were proposed, and this was from the group as a whole, was because Lane County probably has the best program existing in the state for mental health assessment for individuals coming into the facility. The Schuch County, on the other hand, does not have such a program. And what we felt that was important to set a measure so we can see in 2 years for the legislature when it comes back is to whether or not it's necessary to have the front-end assessment as a component that we have within Lane County, or whether or not you can achieve the same results or what type of results you would receive on just on the out, outside use of the services, where someone comes into the system and then they're diverted through either the diversion program of Lane County or through a probation period that comes out of Deschutes County. That is why we thought that it was important to give the measure for this body to be able to determine how much we really need to be able to invest if we need to have it on the front end as much as we do on the tail end. I again would encourage this committee to pass this bill out favorably to Ways and Means for its consideration. I also would tell you that the amount that we're talking about putting in for state dollars with the match of an additional $2 million coming from federal will be a very
high perspective of success for the program to be able to bring back to us what the actual measurements are. And that clearly, I think all of us can say, and I will say for Senator Tarno, from your perspective as being the sheriff down on the coast, that you realize that your facility, as many other facilities in the state, were basically the warehousing for many of these individuals. And instead of utilizing that space at such a cost, that it would be better to have those individuals in a more nurturing situation that can take care of them on the outside in a non-residential setting as necessary, and that we can, in fact, be able to utilize our precious jail space for individuals who really need to be there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Well, we'll move the bill down to Ways and Means today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
We'll close in the public hearing of the work session on Senate Bill 942.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 942.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 942. Discussion? Objections to order?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 942 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee Review Pass Recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves 942 as amended to the Ways and Means Review Pass. Discussion?
Yeah, marking that as a no, and it's not because I don't like the program, I just that I think that we're getting ourselves in trouble. It's a great program, $3 million, and $3 million here and $3 million there. I just want to put a little note of protest as the way we budget and do things. We're doing it on a piecemeal basis, and I think we're going to do this on a general whole basis. So put me down as a no on a protest vote, and I may change my vote on the floor. But
so we'll go down to Ways and Means and Public Safety Committee, where we'll have to look at this more globally as far as what they want to...
I just want that vote recorded.
Fine. Please record, Senator Nelson is a no. Motion carries. Thank you. We'll now go into a public hearing on Senate Bill 811 and Senator Paroli.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. First of all, I'd like to thank you for the public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 811. I appreciate that the committee's work has been rigorous and the agenda seems to be collapsing as we move toward the big passover when we get all the House bills over for consideration. Senate Bill 811 is a relatively simple bill. It recognizes concealed handgun licenses issued by other jurisdictions as being equivalent to licenses issued in Oregon if certain requirements are met. Those requirements appear in lines 3 through 23 of the Act. Essentially, these are the rather strict requirements for Oregonians to have access to licensure for concealed handgun carry under ORS 166.291 and ORS 166.292. And that also includes a determination by the state police that the jurisdiction that issued the out-of-state license recognizes Oregon concealed handgun licenses to the same extent. So this features several things. First of all, a person who has a out-of-state concealed license permit for a handgun carry would be at least 21, not a resident of Oregon, has in the person's immediate possession and has been issued a license to carry a concealed handgun by another state, territory, or political subdivision of the U.S., and that license was issued after the usual, customary, background checks for both mental health and criminal activity, records checks, and that there are no strictures against possessing a firearm by that person. Further, the issue would be that the state police would have determined that the jurisdiction issuing the permit recognizes Oregon concealed carry permits as well. So the reciprocity bill has all the same safeguards that we have for the Oregon issuance of a concealed handgun carry permit. It also features the affirmative defense potential in case the permittee doesn't have his license or her license in their possession at the time. If there was a question about the legality, they could offer the affirmative defense of producing the document. It would have to have been in effect during the stop or the question. I put this bill forward because I've been asked by legislators in other states if we would participate in a reciprocity program.
And I bring this bill before the committee today because I think that it recognizes that folks who have gone through the standard training requirements that exist today for concealed weapons permit carry in Oregon and have completed the necessary background checks, registered their photographic image and their fingerprints with the state police, and thereby doing the National Crime Information Clearinghouse files, and have qualified the background check for mental health and criminal behavior, and who have been issued a license in other states, constitutes reasonable safeguards to the general public that they are responsible citizens and therefore should be allowed to exercise their Second Amendment rights under the Constitution, their First Amendment rights under the Oregon State Constitution. Folks that are incapable of qualifying for these carry standards, if they do carry a weapon, are already violating Oregon law, and there is no stricture in this bill that would affect that in any way. So basically, we've got a straightforward reciprocity bill that includes one other provision, and that's a determination by the Oregon State Police that other jurisdictions also recognize our concealed weapons carry permits.
Ken, I have some questions, and I'm not an expert in this area, but the other requirements under Oregon law to obtain the license is that there can't be any outstanding warrants, and you're not out on a pretrial release of some sort. And the final one is that you've gone through some form of competency as far as a safety course, those sorts of things. Is it uniform? Do other states require those items also before they issue a concealed gun license?
Mr. Chairman, the concealed handgun licenses vary. There are probably 30 different variations. And they go from a very strict educational requirements, and some even have field exercise requirements. Oregon's is about in the middle. So some are much more strict and some are much less strict. The least restrictive, I believe, is in one of the New England states that has a stricture that says any citizen may carry a concealed handgun without a permit or further requirement.
Which state is that?
I think that is
Vermont.
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 One of the original colonies.
The Vermonters take their gun ownership rights very seriously, apparently. That would not fall under this Senate bill or the resulting Oregon revised statutes because, in fact, people in Vermont don't have licenses, so there's no reciprocity in that case. So it's only in the case where a state has a licensure law and the individual who would be carrying the concealed handgun in Oregon actually has a license issued to them from the other state and has it in their possession.
Would you object if line 14, subparagraph B, read that the out-of-state license was issued under circumstances or criteria at least as restrictive as Oregon, because then it would bring in the outstanding warrants, the pretrial release, and the competency element in addition to the criminal background and mental health check?
In concept, Mr. Chairman, I would have no objection at all to having the at least as concept included in the bill. The only issue that I would bring for your consideration would be the determinant or the determining agency would have to be someone competent to review the laws of 50 other states to determine whether they were at least as restrictive as the state of Oregon. And I think that could add significantly to the cost of the administration of this bill. The point here is to make reciprocity a relatively easy thing. I think the Department of State Police could make a literature check and determine whether or not the licensure requirements were at least as strict. So I think that would not be the difficult part. It's the analysis of each of those laws for all 50 states to get to the at least as place. So I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, that I have no objection to the idea that
the handgun license should be, in fact, at least as restrictive as the state of Oregon. I just don't want to send somebody at the Oregon State Police Office or the Department of Justice through 50 different sets of statutes with a relative rating.
And my final question, under the affirmative defense, what happens now when someone from Washington comes into Oregon, has a valid Washington State concealed handgun license, and brings that into Oregon and for some reason is stopped?
They're subject to arrest and prosecution depending on the a situation as determined by the county district attorney, and they can offer a defense. There is no statutory affirmative defense at this point for a concealed handgun license from another jurisdiction. So this creates that, but right now it's simply a matter of courtesy at points in time. Sometimes there is courtesy offered to a concealed handgun license holder from another state, and other times the depending on the circumstances of the arrest, there could be a prosecution. And I guess, Mr. Chairman, that's the example that you bring up is a good example because there are literally tens of thousands of people that reside in Washington that work, do business, recreate, and travel into Oregon on a daily basis. And theoretically, the percentage of folks that carry concealed handguns pursuant to a permit issued in Washington are felons when they cross the state line of Oregon.
I have to tell you, I had read this bill earlier today. I was feeling somewhat receptive until we started going through the juvenile crime prevention stuff, and the fellows from the Institute of Violence talked about, or at least in the materials, there were four accelerators of juvenile violence, and one of them happened to be access to guns. And so I guess my question for you is, why do we care if other people come to the state with more handguns? I mean, what's the big deal here? I mean, is it going to hurt our tourism economy? I mean, what's the concern?
The concern, Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, is that folks who have exercised due diligence in pursuing the training requirements, submitted their names, address, personal information, mental health history, and criminal background check are probably responsible citizens, and and I'm not sure it's in Oregonians or the society's best interest to make them feel or, in fact, criminalize their behavior if they come across the state line. And let me suggest to you that the alternatives for persons that are licensed in other states and they come into Oregon are somewhat limited. You come into the state, you stop at the first convenient place, or perhaps if you're really diligent, you stop before you cross the state line, and then you lock up your concealed weapon in the car and possibly leave it unattended. A concealed weapon is a handgun carry license is for a handgun to be kept continuously under the control of a licensee. So when you lock it up in a car, possibly there's a problem. If you stick it in the glove compartment, it's a concealed weapon without a license under your control. That's a felony. If you put it on the front seat of your car, which is actually what a prudent person might do, so that you're not carrying a concealed weapon, it's possible that under an ordinary traffic stop, you put yourself or the officer in jeopardy. You lock it up in the car and leave it when you do your shopping or your business. You're leaving a potentially lethal weapon out of the control of the licensee and unattended in an automobile. So the alternatives are not necessarily good for those people that have licenses. They should be keeping those weapons continuously under personal control.
Sure, just one last thought. Do you know how many people were actually prosecuted last year in the state of Oregon from out of state with concealed, and had concealed weapons permits from other states and actually carrying handguns in Oregon?
Ma'am, I do not. I know of one rather prominent case that happened in Portland area where a person had a car towed. And because he didn't have a valid license in the state of Oregon, the officer subsequently found the a weapon in the front seat of the car, or under the front seat of the car, which is a sort of a natural thing to do if you wanted to conceal a weapon, and that's considered a concealed weapon in violation of Oregon state statute, and they were prosecuted. So I don't think it's the most inconvenient or most prosecuted crime in Oregon. The intent here is to make
life a little bit less inconvenient for those licensees from other states that come and do business in Oregon, and those Oregon licensees that go to other states. But the need for a concealed weapon doesn't stop because you cross the river or the bridge.
How many states? Washington has the policy.
Washington has a bill that they have been considered. As a matter of fact, just the concept of this came from the conferences with the legislators in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana.
So I
think they're considering reciprocity, but I'm not sure.
Does Idaho have what reciprocity?
I don't know of any state that currently offers reciprocity with Oregon. And when you ask the legislators why, it's because that Oregon doesn't offer reciprocity with them.
Well, but they have reciprocity law.
I'm not sure they have reciprocity law.
Okay. It isn't just Oregon, it's just that they may not have their reciprocity. Okay. Thank you, Senator.
Senator
Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said that this bill came out of conversations with legislators from other states.
Yes.
Was this just a continuous state, or what states in particular did the legislatures ask you to consider this?
Mr. Chairman, the Senator Burdick, State of Washington.
State of Washington.
There was a reciprocity bill in Washington State Legislature. I haven't tracked it. And the legislators that I spoke to agreed that we would drop a reciprocity bill in Oregon and Washington as the beginning of this process.
Chairman Spahn.
Yeah, Senator Burke.
Is that the only state that has asked you to do this?
At this point in time, it is. I will be intending to correspond with other Western states legislatures, probably through the Western States Government's organization.
Thank you. Other questions?
Thanks for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate it very much.
You may want to stay for a few minutes.
I shall do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
People who oppose so you can hear their testimony. Russ Spencer, Sherwood Stillman, and Ann Kelly. Ann Kelly Keene, excuse me.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sherwood Stillman, and I'm here representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I would like to start off by reading a prepared letter that I have sent copies to the members. The Oregon State Sheriff opposed Senate Bill 811, which allows a person to carry a concealed firearm in the state of Oregon if the person possesses a concealed handgun license from another state. With the recent appellate decision under State of Oregon v. Robert William Bruce, this legislation would open Pandora's box. Presently, a resident of a contiguous state may apply to a sheriff of this state upon a showing of a compelling business interest or other legitimate demonstrated need. To affirm or deny the existence of a concealed handgun license, we need only to look to the records in lead. This is because of the law requiring the sheriff, upon the issuance of a concealed handgun license, to enter the applicant's name into the law enforcement data system indicating that the person is an applicant or a license holder. If Senate Bill 811 becomes law, the state would be required to prove anyone living in another state who is found to be in possession of a concealed firearm in violation of ORS 166-250 was not issued a license by that state. In that we are not aware of the records-keeping requirements for concealed handgun license holders of other states, it would be an insurmountable task to prove an out-of-state resident did not possess such a license. For the record, I would also like to read the final, under that cite that I just mentioned, the court stated, "We conclude that ORF 166-251-D requires the state to prove, as an element of the offense, that defendant did not have a license to carry the firearm as required by law." Now, in essence, it is very easy for us, for the prosecutor, to make a prima facie case under 166-250 because of the checks and balances that we have placed in the law for Oregon concealed handgun license holders. The sheriff enters all the holders into the lead system. If the prosecutor needs to prove the case by proving that a person does not possess a concealed handgun license in the state of Oregon, the sheriff merely, or the prosecutor merely contacts the concealed handgun license holder for the, of the county in which the person resides, and subpoenas them to court, and they testify that this person has not been issued a concealed handgun license, and therefore, and then the prosecutor makes the case. We do not know how they handle things in Louisiana or Mississippi or other places, and we would not know who to go to subpoena the court to prove or to make this to prove that the person was not issued a license in that jurisdiction. This is what I referred to by an insurmountable task. And lastly, I would just like to, I guess more posing of a question than making a statement, but as I understand Senate Bill 811, on line 17, it states, the Department of State Police has determined that the jurisdiction that issued the out-of-state license recognizes Oregon concealed handgun licenses to the same extent as this section recognizes out-of-state licenses. Now, under the statutes right now, under the public building statute, a concealed handgun license holder can carry a loaded firearm into any public building, absent a courthouse, of course, including these chambers. Now, if this bill becomes law, an out-of-state resident who is licensed could also carry his .44 or whatever into these chambers. Now, the question, to the extent I guess I'm posing, is it the intent of this bill that we will only recognize the states who allow our concealed handgun license holders to carry firearms in their Senate chambers? Or what exactly does to the extent mean? Because that's the extent that we would recognize other states.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Russ Spencer for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Just a couple of comments I would add in addition to those of Captain Stillman. We're concerned about what the inevitable results of a bill like this would be should it pass, and the message versus the reality. Currently, if we stop an Oregonian who has a valid concealed handgun license and we run a check on them through LEDS, it comes back and tells us this person is clearly CHL is valid. If they have committed an offense which would result in that license being invalid or revoked, we know that right away as well. So we can make a determination right then and there as to whether that person is lawfully possessing a firearm. If we have somebody who has an out-of-state license, there's no way that we are going to know if they're on some form of pretrial release, if there's a misdemeanor warrant out for their arrest. Any of those types of things are not going to pop up for us on LEDS. And so we're going to have to really make the presumption, I think, in most cases, that the person may be prohibited, and we're going to have to seize the weapon. That being the case, now we've got some people that have some weapons that are seized and facing some criminal charges. They're going to have to stick around and adjudicate those. That's a concern. It's a concern that that gun holders or gun owners are going to know which states we have reciprocity with and which we don't. We're concerned that we're going to know which states we have reciprocity and which ones we don't, given how the legislative picture shifts on this issue on a continuing basis. Those are concerns that we have. I'm also concerned, and the sheriffs are concerned, in that we are, as you know, in the process of some sort of intense and ongoing discussions revolving a broad spectrum of handgun and long gun issues over in the House, and we've been discussing a number of proposals around reciprocity. And I guess I would say that I would ask your indulgence, or your patience anyway, to see if we are able to come to some fruition in that process where we work with the gun lobby and the legislature and law enforcement to see what we can come up with. Some of the concepts that have come out of that have been the concept of having out-of-state citizens able to apply for an Oregon concealed handgun license, have that limited to an annual basis so that we can check up on an annual basis to determine whether they've done any prohibited acts or not. We looked at giving the district attorneys the ability to reduce to a violation a charge of unlawful possession if they meet a number of circumstances not present where a crime has been committed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'd also like to address the issue of the interstate reciprocity question regarding Washington, Idaho, and so forth. Under current Oregon law, you do allow for residents of contiguous states to apply for an Oregon concealed handgun license. The difference in the law in that respect for out-of-state residents versus Oregonians is that the sheriff retains the discretion to approve or deny that handgun license. Under Oregon law, if you're an Oregon citizen and you meet all of the requirements set forth in the statutes, we don't have any choice. We must issue that license. So we believe there is a mechanism in place for those who can demonstrate a need that that we can accommodate those. Now, it is a discretion issue, and you may hear from others that they're not seeing approval rates at the level they would like, and I guess that's an issue to be taken up at a local level.
Do you have any report from the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office? How many requests are made and how many are approved?
I don't have that, Mr. Chairman, but I would assume that it would be available.
If you could find that out for me, I'd be curious.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to see what type of problem it may or may not be.
Okay. And just from a technical point of view, we have looked at, in our discussions over on the other side, what might be the appropriate organ to look at comparing concealed weapons licenses throughout the 50 states. And our recommendation to you would be that perhaps the Criminal Justice Commission might be better equipped to perform that function than the Department of State Police. I believe that's a view that the Department of State Police share. And then finally, Claudia had been here till 5 and had to leave, but she wanted me to let you know that their determination, the fiscal impact of this is fairly small, but she thought it might run to around the equivalent of 1/8 of an FTE.
Thank you.
For OSB.
Good afternoon, Senator Bryant, committee members. I will be brief by handing you written testimony in opposition to Senate Bill 811 and supporting the gentleman here position and the facts stated in my testimony in writing having to do with other states and the disparity between their thoroughness in background checks and their statutory investigation of people that would lead to a concealed weapons permit, so that we would feel that this would open Oregon to a much graver threat to have this liberalization of carrying guns in Oregon at a time when the public is certainly moving away from encouraging more guns available easily to the public.
Thank you. Thank you for being brief and also giving us your written testimony.
I also would note for you that I represent a number of organizations that have come together, and it's just a small sampling of the many out there that do and are concerned about the liberalization of gun laws in Oregon.
Questions for the Senate? Yes, Senator Carl.
Mr. Spencer or Captain Stillman, what does OSP and Chief have this on you guys?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I probably should have been clear on that. I actually should have identified myself as also speaking for the Oregon Law Enforcement Legislative Committee, which comprises the sheriffs, the chiefs of police, state police, district attorneys, and also the Portland Police Bureau.
Broader umbrella. Other questions? Yes, Senator Murphy.
Just one briefly. The issue that Senator Farioli, this is for Captain Stillman, the issue that Senator Farioli brought up about people becoming criminals by virtue of coming across the river with their concealed weapon, in your view, does our current system whereby people in Washington can apply for permits, in your view, based on your experience, does that really address that issue?
Oh, absolutely. We have a significant amount of citizens from Washington, some from California, who have even come up from the Los Angeles area and applied for concealed handgun licenses. The only requirement that the sheriffs make is that you provide us with documentation about a legitimate business need or other demonstrated need, and that the state send us a copy or a letter certifying that they have checked their mental health records and that this person has not been committed. And we do make sure that they do that. But we have, is in place now, and it's available to any of those citizens from Washington that have to work in the Portland area and are very concerned about their safety or whatever if they work late at night or early in the mornings.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up. In your view, has that level of thoroughness resulted in a good system in those. These people are tending not to get into trouble with their weapons.
We have had no problems that I am aware of, and I'm usually made of most of the I'm made aware of most of the problems that, that come forth in regards to concealed handgun licenses. We have had no problems from out-of-state residents who have applied to us or other sheriffs within Oregon and have been issued concealed handgun licenses.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, sir.
Our final two witnesses on Senate Bill 811 are Kevin Sterrett and Rod Harder. Oh, and John Helen.
Sure.
As you're coming up, did you watch Meet the Press this week?
Actually, no.
Charlie Heston was on. It was this week.
Kevin Pokey, I believe.
Right, right.
That's one of the reasons I'm thankful I'm not representing the National Rifle Association right now.
It's just for the committee's edification. He was asked about gun shows, and he said that the NRA was in favor of an instant check at a gun show, but did not like the record-keeping requirement. I've never heard the NRA say that before, but
I don't think they had either.
No, they hadn't. I can assure you that. In Mr. Heston's defense, he is quite elderly and very sick. For the record, I'm Kevin Sterrett, and I represent the Gun Owners of America and the Oregon Firearms Federation here in Oregon. And I want to thank the sponsors of this bill, some of whom are on this committee. I believe it's very well intentioned. I would like to address some of the points that were already made. First of all, there are several other states that recognize any state's permit, among them Indiana and Michigan, personal experience in Indiana. None of the states that recognize any other state's permits, irrespective of the level of competency or training required, has ever had any problem with out-of-state license holders. The state of Vermont was mentioned, and as some of you know, the state of Vermont requires no pistol license at all for anyone who has the legitimate right to carry a pistol. And interestingly enough, Vermont has the lowest crime in the country. Now, that may be a coincidence. I don't think so. But the fact that other states are recognizing our permits and the permits of other of the entire country and have demonstrated no problem at all indicates to me that simply because somebody lives in Indiana or Kentucky or Alaska, that they are not necessarily crazy or dangerous. Most states, in fact, have far more restrictive permit laws than we have. As far as Washington is concerned, Washington State tried and failed to pass a similar reciprocity bill, and therein is one of the problems that I have with this bill, is that if it's a strictly a reciprocity bill, it's a question of who's going to go first. Well, I would think that because most states have far more stringent requirements than we have, we should simply accept their permits and not force them to jump through any more hoops. As far as states, contiguous states being allowed to get permits here, well, yes, they're allowed to get permits here if the sheriff in question decides that they are allowed to. And you will recall that when sheriffs had the discretion to issue pistol permits in the state before 89, very few were issued. Why somebody who lives in Washington has to demonstrate a compelling business interest and jump through those hoops when Washington is perfectly happy to offer an Oregonian a permit by simply applying for it and passing a background check is something I don't understand. I have friends, colleagues in Washington, and they're really not very different from us. It's not a separate planet. I was a little concerned about the testimony that the members of law enforcement gave saying that if they needed to determine what the laws were in all 50 states, that they simply couldn't do that. In 1991, when I moved here with a New York City permit, which you can't even imagine how difficult that is to get, the law said that Oregon would recognize any state's permit that was substantially similar to Oregon's. Well, at the time, the Oregon State Police were quite capable of figuring out that not a state in the Union had laws that were comparable to Oregon's. So their ability to determine which state's laws are comparable to ours would seem to me to be something they certainly can do. As far as the notion of the message that is being sent about more guns, people who go through this process have demonstrated themselves over and over in every state and every county in this country, has to which has even been testified to by the police. These people are not a problem, and that the people who are a problem are going to ignore any law you write anyway. So I would say that while I certainly support this, I would only say that it probably would be better if it simply recognized the licenses of other states and also took into account the fact that very, very decent law-abiding people from Vermont will not be able to carry in Oregon, although other people will, because they simply don't offer permits and therefore they can't fit through that hoop. But I support the intentions and just think that it would be probably be to the benefit of all Oregonians if more people who demonstrated competency and a willingness to abide the law were allowed to carry firearms in the state.
John.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Helen with Oregon Gun Owners. Just to address a couple of key issues, one of the comments that very much concerned me was Catherine Stillman's comments regarding Washington State residents being allowed to apply in Oregon, as long as they demonstrate a legitimate business or compelling need. Now, to me, that is completely offensive. When we say to Oregonians, all you got to do is go through these hoops, and then we say to Washingtonians, well, you're different. You're different, but as long as, and as Kevin said, Washington State has the same, if not more, intense requirements than Oregon does, and they issue licenses to not only their citizens, but to ours without question, just doing the processes. It seems to me highly offensive that when we have a border that shares as large a metropolitan area as we do, as much interstate traffic as we have between them, why is it all of a sudden when you cross that water that you're no longer the same person in this country? That is wholly offensive to us. The right to self-defense does not stop because you cross water. And that is what this issue is about. At the beginning of the session, we gave you a book, More Guns, Less Crime, by Professor Watt. That information is hard statistical evidence that shows the more you issue these licenses, the more that people subject themselves to government requirements to be issued that license, the more law-abiding they will be. And as a result, they are available to handle situations that arise when law enforcement cannot be there. And that's the other key issue about this. Court after court ruling has determined that the law enforcement does not have an obligation to protect you, just to preserve the peace and to be available, but they are not required to respond to every incident. Therefore, citizens should have the ability to respond to that incident. And if you're not in your house, if you're not even in your own state, why is there a safety concern any different because you're on the Oregon coast than it is if you're sitting in Spokane, Washington? Those are the philosophical questions that you need to look at, I believe, to assess whether this is a responsible approach to making sure that citizens have the ability, regardless of their state of residency, assuming, and we'll agree, that they should meet Oregon's requirements. But otherwise, if they can demonstrate they are acceptable to Oregon's requirements, then it should be a logical conclusion that they be allowed to carry. Now, with regards to the Senator Brown's question as to why do we care, I think I just addressed that as far as we should care, because if you're with your family vacationing, your safety is no less important in Oregon than it is in Washington or wherever you're coming from. And then with regards to Ms. Feeney's statements regarding the disparity between the thoroughness of the checks, again, that's handled if you put the language in regarding the requirements that they meet Oregon State stringent requirements. And with that, I think that pretty much addresses our concerns, and I'm open for any questions.
Questions for the panel? Thank you for your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on 811 and open the work session on Senate Bill 482, the Dash 2 Amendments. Are ready?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I think Representative King is here. He spoke to the committee the last time, but we have the Dash 2 Amendments before you, and they would replace the bill. Rather than calling for a Class C felony, that two sections. The first section would allow for the recovery of $1,000 in damages, intended to be liquidated damages. You wouldn't have to prove the fact that you were sit upon, that you actually suffered that injury, because it would be an assumption that that's what the injury would be.
And you would also recover attorney's fees.
That's correct.
Which would cause you to find someone who's probably be willing to file the action for you, or taking the small claims court. So it's my fix. And then on the back part, we reduce it from a Class C felony
to a misdemeanor, but it can elevate to a higher misdemeanor or felony depending on what the action is.
Chairman, the committee actually, Section 3 does it in harassment statute, because most of the conduct we heard about didn't rise to the level of assault, but around to the harassment. And what it would be if you spit upon a sports official, that is within the harassment statute now. What this would do, if it's a sports official is defined in Section 1 of the fact, it would be elevated to a Class A misdemeanor.
Mr. Chair, I move that to Amendment Senate Bill 482.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves to dash two amendments. Senate Bill 482, discussion. Objection.
The word. Chair, I move Senate Bill 482 as amended to the floor due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Courtney has moved Senate Bill 482 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objection. The word. Yes, Senator Bird.
Mr. Chairman, I would like an amendment attached requiring the good representative to wear his outfit again. His fuchsia one. We particularly request his fuchsia one.
Senator Schroe wasn't sent the bill in. Should we...
I can arrange that.
Ask him if he'd like to carry it, and if not, I'd be happy to, since I added the civil penalty and put it in the record.
Poor Senator Courtney would die to carry this bill. He would die.
Soccer tie. Representative, do I get a soccer tie now?
Absolutely.
I thought so.
I think you earned one, don't you?
I don't. All right, we'll now go to work session on Senate Bill 18. Mr. Taylor, you have the dash two amendments.
Chairman of the committee, we have the dash two amendments before us. What this does, the original bill allows consolidation of multiple probation violations. The dash two amendments do the same thing, but they set forth a process and procedure for doing this. It's mandated and allows it to be done.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments.
Thank you. And it's good. Ann's got the sister all this time. Good afternoon. Senator Brown moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 18. Discussion. Objection. Senator Brown moves Senate Bill 18 as amended to floor due pass. Discussion, objections. Senator Brown, would you carry?
I'd be delighted.
Thank you.
Good work, Vinny. We're adjourned.
Sorry, can you just give me a little bit?
Well.